Much of Ian's writing explores the psychogeography of London, its ever-changing terrain and alternative histories. His prolific career has yielded novels, non-fiction, poetry and films. His books include London Orbital, his acclaimed meditation on the M25, and last year he edited London, A City of Disappearances. Ian Sinclair, you're very welcome to the 11th Hour.
Thank you very much.
I suppose the first question I have to ask you is, explain and discuss the term psychogeographer.
Oh, if I can even pronounce it. It's a funny term. It's a term really that's gone completely out of context. It began in the 1960s with the French, like so much else at that time. And these were people called situationists in Paris who had the idea that to regenerate the urban environment, you would have to turn maps into poetry, if you like. You know, in a sense, you'd navigate your way around Paris by using a map of Venice, or the other way around. You'd have to do something extreme to bring this urban sprawl back into life. And after a long period out of fashion, people started to use this term again because the cities were becoming, particularly places like London, overwhelming sprawls that you couldn't get a handle on at all. And the only way to operate this was to be subversive and conceptual and look at it in a different way.
And would that looking at a different way be relevant to the redevelopment of a city? Would there be any of this philosophy that could be brought to bear?
Yeah, it counters that. You know, I think the sort of occult magic of capital at the time of Margaret Thatcher's sudden remaking of the whole riverscape, that one night I can remember, you know, I used to be a gardener down in Limehouse and I used to go out with tractors and cut the grass in schools down in this apparent wilderness, a kind of wasteland. And then overnight, almost a city like sort of Batman's Gotham had grown up out of nothing. But it wasn't really London. It was this computer-generated city. It was a kind of comic book city with no infrastructure. And to counter that, to do something interesting to oppose it, then I think these things called psychogeography or rituals or walks or whatever you want to do, something had to be done by the writers and poets to have a genuine opposition to what was going on from the state.
You mentioned Thatcher there, and you have said that you can't understand Thatcher except in the terms of bad magic. What do you mean by that?
I mean, what was happening seemed extraordinary to explain in England at that time, that somebody could come in with such a dynamic will and enforce it on, as it appeared, on great swathes of the city. How did it work? And it struck me, it was a kind of form of black magic almost, that the bad will of the people, all the worst elements, all the kind of fears about racism or fears about having to own property, all of those things were focused through her, and it was immensely powerful. And thanks to the Falklands War, it became a national obsession. But at the same time, exactly at the same year that the GLC, which was the governing body of London, was abolished, it was a kind of anti-London spirit that was abolished. The Big Bang happened, so the financial markets were loosened up so that London could become a world city of capital and money, but it wasn't itself anymore. And in that very year, the M25 motorway was opened, which fascinated me. It was because suddenly now London is a traffic island. It's actually sealed off by this road that goes right round it, which was really an invention of the 1940s, and if it had been built then, it might have worked. But by the time it happened, it was completely posthumous.
Of course, you dealt with that, all aspects of it, in London Orbital, when you decided to walk around the M25.
Yeah, that was exactly the thing we've been talking about, one of these mad acts that had to be undertaken to counter the overwhelming reality of political life. So, in a part as a sort of magical thing against the dome, which the famous Millennium Dome on Greenwich Peninsula, which I really didn't care for very much, this great round tent, which had sucked up so much money and was doing nothing. I thought I wanted to take the same shape into the landscape, and I walked up the line of zero longitude from Greenwich, which cuts alongside the dome, up the Lee Valley until it hit this motorway, the M25, that goes right round London. And I thought the only way really to make sense of this landscape as to this new England that was emerging was not to drive it, as you would expect, but to walk in the acoustic footprints, which is what highway planners call the distance you can hear the road back from the road. So staying within that area, I investigated the new London, and it's the sort of London that J.G. Ballard writes about, of new peculiar retail parks, airports, asylums, golf clubs, catteries, these kind of phenomena. And it was a very, very interesting and instructive thing to do.
Of course, you walked this road or this area counterclockwise. And you mentioned too that the Victorians had put this geographical distance where the M25 is where they considered it safe for asylums, armament factories, chemical factories, and You suggest this was a safe distance from the city.
This at that time would have been the calculation of the necessary distance you needed to take the troubled and the mad of the inner cities out. For two reasons. One, to sort of remove them from the city. And secondly, because within this pastoral landscape, they would be able to heal and recover. So there was an ambiguity about these huge buildings. The two things were always together. There were sometimes very beautiful parklands and farms that the mad people could work in. And sometimes they were like prisons or very demonic, dark structures. And now, in the course of this walk, we discovered, you know, which I hadn't known about, all of those buildings were being closed down. The people who were left there pretty much turned loose into the community, and the buildings themselves made over often into new gated estates. And they would have to keep the Italianate red towers, which were the water towers of these places, because there were preservation orders on them. So the only way you'd recognize where someone had been an asylum was to see one of these towers. And it was therefore a kind of landscape of forgetting, because I discovered when you went to them, very often the builders would be ordered to burn all the records of the hospital. So you'd see a skip and hundreds of lives of these people who had lived in the inner city in the Victorian Edwardian eras were now just going up in flames. And it was a purposeful erasure of memory to create something for fairly wealthy people to live on in a protected community that was somewhere and nowhere.
To remove all traces of the pain and unhappiness of these places so that people could turn them into luxury apartments or something like that.
Exactly, and very much, you know, the nature of the road being right there seemed in a sense to me to create a kind of centrifugal force spinning around the city into which all the bad karma, all the nightmares would be sucked up into this road and travel round and round London endlessly. And in fact, when you see from space what the city looks like now, there is actually a kind of membrane, a dome of pollution floating over London from all the kind of fog and car exhaust fumes and airplane fumes and things. There is this actual dome, and that seems to me to be defined by where the road itself is.
Your journey along the road, you were informed by history, by architecture, by nature, it's kind of like a holistic approach to this road.
I hope so. Yeah, I think the nice thing was that everything was there. Sometimes I walked with people who were naturalists and who could kind of point to me all the various strange things that were happening with bird life and animal life, and something would skitter across the path, and you realize really what a green city it was, what a strange kind of eruption the buildings became when you were in a natural landscape, and the mixtures between the two, and the kind of secret spaces where things were going on that you hadn't known about, that there was a large armament factory at Enfield, which was in the earlier maps was not even mapped, it was just a blank, it just says government research station or something, and in fact it was where they were researching into bombs and gunpowder, and this was then closed down and it opened up to the public, and what it became in part was a nature reserve, because nobody had been allowed into it for so long that herons had nested and deer had moved in, and so peculiarly the most secret and dangerous elements of the state had also had a kind of ecological benefit, and you got these nature reserves mingling alongside places where peculiar things were still going on.
You're not entirely taken up with this notion of conserving the heritage of a city. You mentioned, is it the Globe? No. Or that without the bear pits or the whorehouses, it doesn't have any context?
No, I think there's been a big argument going on for years and years about the nature of this thing, heritage. And I'm very worried that heritage is just a kind of form of official history written by a class of politicians and explainers, so that if you walk through an unknown and unimagined landscape and what you see is a laminated board put up that tells you four or five interesting historical things, well, that is what the official explanation is. And it discourages you from using your own eyes, your own imagination, finding out the story for yourself. And I think at the moment we've huge developments on the eastern side with the Olympics coming up and a new city, apparently the size of Leeds, to be constructed around Stratford, which was a very run-down urban centre. And what's happening there is that the edge lands, the kind of liminal lands of the city, where people's imaginations could create and discover and make their own walks and journeys, that's now being stripped back and disappearing. And I'm very concerned about a place called Manor Garden Allotments. So it was land that was given 100 years ago as a gift in perpetuity, and which had been ticked all the sort of official Olympic boxes, because the people there had made this poisoned land workable and had grown all kinds of things there. Every single culture was involved, and it was a communal activity, and it did everything. And yet, because it's going to be within the path of just the Olympic fence, the perimeter fence of the Olympic zone, the people there are going to be turned out. And although they were promised another site, they're not actually going to get it. And I find there's a great sense of loss all the time in the city for every new grand project that comes along.
And do you feel that sense of loss for buildings demolished, factories closed down, streets moved on?
Yeah, this is the title of the anthology I did, this big collection that tried to define London. I called it City of Disappearances, because buildings disappear, people disappear. I mean, this is inevitable, and it's not necessarily always bad. What I want, though, is that there's a proper memory, that someone gives an account of the important things, the hurtful things that vanish. Where I live in Hackney in East London, there's been huge change in recent times. You know, you almost wake up and find a different urban landscape in front of you every morning. That there was a Victorian theatre, great huge building on Dalston Lane, that had been converted later to a black music club, and then to a club called Labyrinth, and had then been squatted by anarchists and people. But they were fighting to retain this building because it seemed to be a soul of the area in some ways. And yet, because there's a development that's going to put up a new series of tower blocks and extend the city, this building vanishes overnight, rather dubiously. There's some strange things went on, and before anybody could actually take action, the thing was just raised to the ground. It's gone, and you're left with this ugly lacuna and this great rush towards the ever-expanding monetary zone of the City of London and its towers, so that I think London could seriously lose its identity. I mean, I know huge changes have happened in Dublin, and I'm very kind of keen to come and have a look at that, because I'm sure that the city I was in the early 1960s will be totally unrecognisable.
You won't recognise it, and it'll cost you a fortune, but you'll be welcome. could you give us a reading from London Orbital?
This is just a little piece. I'm doing it because it's part of this landscape I was describing of the new kind of satellite shopping centres and perimeter fences that are turning the city inside out. So that once upon a time, traditionally, Londoners would have made excursions to the coast, to places like Southend and Margate. And now that doesn't happen. If they make an expedition from the city, it's to go to Bluewater, which is actually a chalk quarry which has been dug out and has this enormous city of glass, which is just a huge car park with a shopping centre attached. And after the book had been written, it sort of came into the public zone because some of the bombers who had bombed London on the 7th of July were actually plotting their next thing was to blow up Bluewater, which we didn't know. So they'd become known as a sort of the Bluewater terrorists. And that sense of boredom and terror, again, is what haunts these edge zones.
You're an outsider. You're not from London. Do you think the outsider wants to? I feel the same about my own adopted city. I want to know more about the natives themselves.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I grew up in South Wales. I went to school in Gloucestershire, went to university in Dublin. And then arriving in London, it was always been a kind of destination. And even from Dublin, I used to come across to London a lot. I was very keen on film at that time and filmmaking, and used to kind of come backwards and forwards. You could get a cheap shuttle flight in those days. And London was always the kind of city of my imagination. And I had no idea I would stay here so long. And then realized it was unknowable and unmappable, and always being a fanatic about walking, I started to walk it, and walks become narratives and walks become stories. And in the end, that seems to have become my life, walking around this endlessly changing city and teasing out little narratives, sometimes as fiction, sometimes as documentary. And I don't really think in the end there's much difference between them. I mean, the great thing about Dublin, you know, as Joyce revealed so spectacularly, it was a city that you could walk in a single day. And he reckoned that, with a little conceit, that from the pages of Ulysses you could rebuild a city. Nobody could ever claim or do that with London. It is just too vast and too strange, and therefore it was a perfect subject to take on for a sort of lifetime's work.
On Sunday you'll be talking to Tim Robinson, a man who has created books on Arran and books and a book and most recent book on Connemara, books of immense detail and mythology. Very similar to your own work. What's your conversation going to be about?
I guess it will be about methods of how we work, and also the strangeness of Tim, who is not a native of that part of the world, placing himself there and finding it to be his great work. And in the same way, I really would never have considered that London would be the thing I would obsessively have to. And I'm interested to know how this process happens. And I think if all his particular gifts and talents, because he's much more of a scientific bent than I am, he's a man of great kind of precision, makes his own maps, found in this kind of quite austere landscape to an outsider, the marvellous kind of strange rock formations and the lives he teases out. I'm very interested to know about all that and how it works. It's a kind of romantic landscape to the outsider, and I think it's in the same way London could appear equally forbidding to somebody coming from outside and trying to make a life in it. Although I do find that a lot of the most interesting writing about London has been done by strangers and outsiders. And I guess in a somewhere like London, everybody really is an outsider. Everybody has come from somewhere else. It's just a question of how new an immigrant you are.
Ian Sinclair, thank you very, very much for being with us on the 11th Hour.
Thanks a lot.